Step into Mind Matters, where we reveal the high-stakes world of CEOs, from their first-day jitters to game-changing strategies, and equip you with invaluable insights and practical advice essential for your personal growth and leadership journey. And now, Mind Matters.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Kendall Raessler, and today we're thrilled to have a remarkable guest on our podcast. He brings a wealth of knowledge and expertise as the CEO and founder of Viz Banking. And we can't wait to jump into an insightful conversation with more engaging information on this episode from Brian Pillmore, the CEO. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks so much, Kendall. It's great to be here with you and look forward to learning a little bit more about you and your audience and having a great conversation.
Yes, us as well. And you know, for our audience, Brian, I would like to have them understand a little bit more of your background. If you wouldn't mind giving us a brief bio of yourself and some of the key important professional pieces that's happened in your journey. We would love to have that so they understand more about you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I always say that it's great to start off your career in a big company because it gives you a lot of different opportunities. And that's what I did. I started with a huge company called General Electric. And right out of school, you know, actually, I worked for them for 8 months during school. But graduated on a Saturday and started on a Monday with General Electric. And I was designing hardware and software for them. And I went, you know, after doing that for about a year and a half, I was really enjoying it, really enjoying working with the team members, about 120 engineers in our group, our design group. And I felt like I needed to take the next step to begin, you know, a years-long process of growing as a leader. And so I went to my manager. I said, hey, what can I do to really grow as a leader? And, you know, I'd really like to become an engineering team lead at some point, and then eventually an engineering manager. I really desired that leadership. Yeah. And she said, oh, no problem, Brian. You're on the path. Another 15 or 20 years and you'll be there. And that was not the timeline that I had in my mind. So I stuck it out for another couple of years, but about three and a half years into my time as an engineer, I made a shift from engineering into accounting and finance. And I took that same engineering mindset and you know, problem solving mindset. I took it into accounting and finance and worked as a corporate auditor for 3 years. And that was a fascinating experience. Went to 10 different GE businesses, about half the time in Europe, half the time in the United States. And about half of those businesses were industrial manufacturing companies, and half of them were financial services or banking type companies. And man, talk about like a school of hard knocks MBA. That's what it was for 3 years. And I came out addicted to financial services or banking.
That's awesome. To have that type of diversity, to be all over the world, to get that must bring a lot of great knowledge to you, but also bring some challenges that you had to run through. So when I hear that, you have so many different cultures. And let's look at your first day as being a CEO where you're at today. And let's talk about that, how that is different from when you very first started. What was going through your mind? What was your emotions? What were you feeling? Help explain it to our viewers, because we have some new CEOs listening, and we have some that have been a couple of years, I'll say, more the hair color that I have in here.
Yeah, so I'll take you through my first day as CEO at a bank that I ran, and I started that in June of 2018. Because that was the first role. Up until that point, I had had a CFO role. I had had, you know, a senior vice president role. I had never been a CEO until June of 2018. I stepped into a new company and a new bank. So I was recruited from the outside, and I was 38 years old as a CEO of one of the 8 states of a regional bank here in Oklahoma. So I had the purview of being the CEO for everything that bank did in this state. Day one was overwhelming. And I think, first of all, I didn't know what I didn't know, but it was overwhelming on a number of fronts. One, to get your head around the scope, because typically the CEO job is broader and deeper in scope than any job that you've had before. And so for me, I was just, you know, swimming with alligators. I didn't have a clue of what I didn't know. And so I was thirsty for knowledge. And at the same time, I was going into a situation with a lot of unknowns. New company, that's different. Sometimes people get promoted to the CEO job. I was recruited from the outside and really recruited into a troubled organization, one that had had a significant amount of turnover. It had had some personnel issues where people were actually let go involuntarily, or they resigned because they were going to be let go. And the remaining team had some morale issues. So often, you know, at least for me, when I stepped into the CEO job, in some ways you could probably say it was, why did they get a 38-year-old CEO? I certainly had some great experience, yeah, but they picked a 38-year-old because they had a lot of 55-year-olds tell them, heck no, I'm not going to that CEO job. So sometimes that's a situation you find yourself in, and you better just be honest. Like, I wasn't the most experienced guy, but I was certainly going to learn and do my best.
Well, that brings a lot of challenges coming from the outside in and not being brought up and having to deal with those 55-year-olds that's been in the bank for a long time and saying, well, I don't want to do that piece. That becomes a real culture shock. Absolutely. How did you handle that? And can you give me a couple examples or an example of how you handled your culture inside to metamorph it or keep it the way that you wanted to?
Yeah, and I don't know that I did it the best. Like, in retrospect, there's lots of things that I wish I would have changed, right, or done things a little differently with a little bit more wisdom. But what I attempted to do was, first of all, to set expectations, to clearly communicate my expectations. And an example of that was within the first week having an all-hands meeting, and there were some issues that had occurred with personnel before. I thought and diagnosed myself that some of those had occurred because there wasn't the right cultural expectation of what appropriate behavior in the workplace looked like. And so I had an all hands meeting and laid out that I have a no tolerance policy for harassment. I have no tolerance policy for inappropriate sexual behavior. I just set a different tone. And I, you know, that kind of goes back to when I was in college. I was a resident advisor in a dorm, and I always felt like at the beginning of the year I'd set these expectations and I didn't have any problems on my hall. I don't know if that went over real well, because I think people sometimes, I think they were a little bit overwhelmed by that, like, very direct communication style. But it was true to my leadership style. Like, I don't mess around, and I don't take kindly to you know, like, it's a professional environment. I think we ought to treat it that way. Another example is, you know, when you step into the CEO job, you have a staff of direct report. You're a manager of managers in almost every organization, unless you're in a small startup or something as a CEO. In a larger organization, you're a manager of managers. And I think what's difficult from my own experience is, how do you figure out who you can trust?
Yes,
that's really hard, and the costs of making the wrong call are high. Mm-hmm. And so I think identifying who your supporters, or who your, you know, maybe to put it in a Donald Trump term, like, who your loyalists are,
yeah,
and who may actually be, like, subversive, who's actually working against you, either, you know, in your face or behind the scenes, behind your back. I think in retrospect, I miscalculated on a couple of fronts. People that were working against me behind my back and were kind of doing an end around. And it really weakens your leadership when that kind of behavior is going on. And depending on the situation you're in, you may or may not have the mandate to take action on those people.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
You know, I'm happy that you brought that up and said that, because that's very open, very honest, and it's lots of CEOs run into those challenges. How do you know who to trust? You're walking into an institution. You haven't grown up with them for the last 10, 15 years, so you know very little about them, and you've got to take a lot of words. Did you use any mentors, or what other tools did you use to help do that? And that's question one. And the second one is, I'm really happy that you ran into those troubles, not for the challenges you went through, but for the learning experience that it happens and how that can correlate to our listeners as well. So yeah. I'm giving you
a double. I had really good mentors and was getting lots of good advice from very long time trusted friends, many of whom have been CEOs or CFOs themselves. And the other thing that helped me in that situation was to have a professional coach that I had retained independently and separate from the bank. The bank tried to assign two mentors to me, which I did not find to be as helpful. There was questions of independence, and I also wasn't sure if I could trust them, right? You want, in those mentor relationships or coaching relationships, you want full trust and no fear. You want to be able to be very open. I didn't feel that way with two mentors that were assigned internally to me to help in this turnaround of the organization.
No, that makes a lot of sense to me. So when you were looking at those two CEOs, and we've had CEOs that have had from top down, here's your mentors, you should look and do this. And you're absolutely right. Those questions have to be forefront for you. So what approach did you make in decision-making as a CEO to identify the right ones? Because this will help our people.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I looked at who's helped me throughout my career. And, whether it's some family members that have been in higher ranks within corporate America or my old friends at General Electric, many of whom I had some great folks that actually worked for me that have gone on, far surpassed anything that I'll do in my life. So I, sometimes the mentee becomes the mentor. And I think those are my proudest moments when I can actually turn to someone that I've helped to guide in the past and they can help guide me in the future. And I can think of three of those in particular that were helpful during that time period. One of which I went to visit he was actually running a, you'll enjoy this, Kendall, an oil and gas business, a gas business mostly in Algeria. I went to visit him right before I became the CEO of this company. So those people were very, and so I looked at my history, not so much, and then a professional coach that I retained that was a referral from someone else outside the bank. I looked for that kind of independence, and that's where, I found trust from long-dated relationships and from independently retained advisors rather than from within an unknown organization that I'm trying to navigate.
That there's words of wisdom, lots of words of wisdom in that. I look at CEOs and when they're first starting, they've got pressures, the culture we talked a little bit about. I've got to do all these and spin all these plates and get everything going. And then above you, or whichever way you want to look at your org chart, you've got the board of directors above you and they got their own agenda.
Yeah.
Now, just because you have to come in and change a culture, make some changes there as an example, different processes and put it into place, doesn't mean your board actually sees the value and understands that. How did you handle that?
I think, I'm not sure that I handled it great. I handled it, I think, as best I could. When I communicated the cultural change and they liked what I was doing, but they didn't necessarily like how I was doing it. So my leadership style was different than the chairman of the board's style in particular. Mm-hmm. And he had been in this seat before. That's the other thing that's interesting is when you have board members that have done the job before. So they have opinion of how it ought to be done versus a board member that has not been in the chair, has done something else independent. And, they sometimes have a better listening ear of what you're trying to do and more sympathetic to a different approach. And then I think the other piece, the cultural change was one thing, but this bank also needed some financial change. And so I was in the midst of driving that, which was, not as focused internally. The cultural change was an internal change. The financial change was an outward business development, commercial focus with customers. And that was very, very successful on two fronts. One is winning new business, which I think, depending on the CEO, that hopefully they're, you know, also a revenue officer in chief in some way, depending on their background. And then secondly, being focused on profitability as a CEO, I think taking the business you already have or you are winning and making sure that that business is as profitable as you can, as it can be, that was really, and that kind of feeds like the data geek that's inside of me looked at, you know, our total number of customers, really core commercial customers of around 300 customers, and identified, you know, 50 to 75 of those customers that were just not profitable.
Right. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Now, that makes just many questions jump to my mind. And one of them is, you're right. Hey, you hope that the CEOs had a CRO role, you know, as revenue driven, because bonuses are based upon that. Your board and chair want to make sure that happens. But have you ever been handed something, Brian, that you hadn't managed before as being the CEO? And every one of the CEOs is brand new or in the mid are having this happen. Can you explain how you felt and what you did, how you managed around that? Because when you know something, it's easier. When you don't, please help me.
Yeah, in particular within banking, I've never had an underwriting job. I've never, you know, it's kind of funny. I try to be as good at it as I can, but when somebody looks at my resume and kind of drills in, they're like, oh, this guy's never been an underwriter, which is really like the core, like people that come into banking right out of school, they go to like a credit school, and I've never done that. So I've been president. I've never actually gone through formal credit training, which is, it's kind of, it makes me laugh when I think about it for too long. But then I get back to business and say, well, what do you do when you're completely lacking a skill like that that's really core to the bank? Number one, you better do your homework at night, right? You better be like reading up and doing the best you can to be educated. Two, ask a dumb question, because you're allowed, like I asked lots of dumb questions in the first 6 months. Those questions are allowed in the first 6 months, but if you ask them in month seven, you look like an idiot. Right?
Yeah, and you don't want perception to become reality, right?
Oh, man. And then third, I just found I had a guy that sat two doors down from me that he was the guy that was formally credit trained, right? He worked for a big Japanese bank. He worked for JP Morgan on Wall Street. He had done the job. He had been to the training. And so like, he was like my sidekick in the course of that, you know, especially the first 6 months, if not the first year, he was a sidekick. Whenever I was writing up a 150 page credit memo on an existing customer or a new customer, he was right there.
Back to team. It's important. It's important to run the ship, but you need everybody else on there in order to make it go the right direction. That communication is a huge and important piece. And communication comes with a lot of time used up. You know, you've got all these plates that you're spinning and making sure everything is done and working properly. So you're reporting to everything, which, you know, there's more to life than just work. There's called the work-life balance. How do you handle that?
I had a team member on the work-life balance side. She was from China, and she said to me, she said, Brian, in my culture, we like to say when work equals life, then the equation is balanced. I said, well, that's not exactly what we're communicating here when we say work-life balance. But I think, you know, for me, I firmly believe that when you get in the CEO chair, hopefully you're really good at what you do, so you can do more in less time. And on top of that, as your boss, the chairman as your boss, the shareholders, stakeholders as your boss, you got to report in and deliver the goods, and you have to lead your team. But hopefully at that stage in your life, when you have that CEO title, you've bought yourself time and location freedom. And if you've bought yourself time and location freedom, that is something that's really, really, really important to me. Mm-hmm. That time and location freedom buys you work-life balance as long as you seize it. So for me, what that looks like is I can be where I want, when I want, doing what I want, and still keeping the plate spinning. And And instead of taking like self-limiting beliefs, like, oh man, if I'm not in this office, the place is going to fall apart. Instead, free yourself from that. Get out of the office. See if it falls apart. If it falls apart, figure out what fell apart. Fix it so you can get back out of the office.
So what I'm hearing is cut, measure, cut, measure, cut, measure. Find out how you fail, where you fail. Fix it so that it's not redundantly failing.
I agree with that completely. I think, and then take advantage. Like, yeah. You know, nobody's asking you to be in the office. Get out with customers. Do what's really, think about what's really high value that only you can do. And then the other stuff, get other people to do stuff that's really high value that you are uniquely talented and empowered to do. Do it. And how much time does that take? For me, it's business development and it's financial. Those are the two things that really drive a ton of value for a bank. And so I spend my time on those things and try to give everything else to other team members.
Thank you so much for that, Brian. You know, I think our CEOs will get a lot of that, especially our newer ones and mid ones, because they get lost in it a lot. They get stuck into their life and their work that's all it is one jar. And in some people, it works to be in one jar. Some people need to divide the jars. But let's talk about scaling now. You talked about life balance and heaven. What's in scaling? What has given you the most ability to scale? Is it technology? Is it your processing? Well, what do you feel that you can share with CEOs that's given you the ability to scale the most and quickly?
This episode is powered by Onist AI. Onist's optimized onboarding process and minimized documentation result in an expedited and seamless financing journey for clients, enhancing their contentment and commitment. Through identity verification, financial data validation, and creditworthiness assessment, our software empowers companies to make well-informed financing choices, bolster application speed and customer uptake by 30%, and cut operational costs by a significant 70% with Onist AI. For more information, visit onist.ai.
For me, there's three things that help me to scale. One is replicating myself. Ooh. The second would be technology. And the third would be systems or processes. And kind of with that comes communication. But replicating myself, I figured out after three administrative assistants in 3 years, I figured out administrative assistants are not for me. Why? Well, because the barriers come down on doing a lot of the things that the traditional administrative assistant can do. What I need is a chief of staff that is capable of doing almost everything I can do. Mm-hmm. So today I have a chief of staff. He has a bachelor's in chemical engineering and a master's in macroeconomics. He is extremely bright, 15 years my junior, but when he's my age, he'll far surpass me, right? So I call him my chief of staff. He's capable of doing anything I can do. And I train him on something once, or I teach him on something once, and he's off to the races, self-directed typically for 8 to 12 hours at a time of self-direction. Whereas an administrative assistant is not a self-directed, has to be directed at each step. Technology, I'm blown away by it, right? I think I used to think that the ship had sailed, like around the early 2000s, the old dot-com boom. I was like, oh man, I missed the boat. I graduated in 2004 in a computer engineering field. Like the time had passed. The greatest time for technology advances and dot-com startups. And man, I miss the wave. This right now, what we're living in right now, and I think probably to the end of my working life in the next 20 years, will be the greatest wave that we've seen. It is the equivalent of an 1890s, early 1900s industrial revolution for technology. You know, the PC, the development of the personal computer and the age of the internet, that's small potatoes compared to what we're encountering today. And so whether it's the empowerment of large language models and artificial intelligence, or the ability to displace traditional statistical or actuarial data analysis with learning and deep learning. The use of technology, and at least, I mean, I have a little benefit of being classically trained in computer engineering and in computer science, but I think anybody can capture this. Like, it just takes a brain and reading and some curiosity, and you will capture it. You don't have to be the expert to do it all. That would be a mistake. Find great, smart people, and it's a global world, right? And last, go ahead.
Oh, no, please. And last, no, I would not.
Okay. Yeah, the last, like, systems, processes, and with that comes communication. I think, like, defining the system and the process is a higher level activity. But if you can trickle that down and teams can implement that, whether that's implemented in technology or human systems, that's the key. If every day, like I used to say to my credit, back to like bank underwriting and credit people, I was like, guys, is every deal that I bring to you a new deal? No, find the common denominators, define the process, define the system, right? Yes. Is there something unique about every deal? Of course. But there's more things in common. So don't treat they treated everything as a one-off. And that's what GE, that's what the General Electric mindset was from. It goes back to the core, whether you're, didn't matter what GE business you were in, goes back to the manufacturing process, right? Mm-hmm. About defining the problem and, you know, identifying potential solutions and experimenting and testing. And, you know, it's a defined process. And that can happen in every part of business.
You know, Brian, I heard you talk about the technology, and then I heard you just incorporate the culture back into it again in your last statement that you just said. And it makes all the sense in the world. People are scared of technology. And you're right. You don't need to be scared. You don't need to be the guru of it. You need to embrace it. I agree with you. This world has come to a place that the technology we're about to see and learn is going to surpass everything. There's so many CEOs that are scared of it, especially in the banking world, because when I did it this many years ago, this is the way it was. And we've all heard that statement before, right? And I know we got to do it this way. Well, no, because you got to shift the culture. You got to embrace the technology. And many CEOs, and I want to get your take on this, feel that technology, oh, I missed the boat in 2000 because I graduated in 2004. Oh, last year I didn't jump on AI, and AI is a big buzzword. But what advice would you give to them about timing and fear in that area?
As a 42-year-old tech startup guy, I'm like the ancient guy. But there's some real benefits to being ancient. Like, the small stuff doesn't faze you, and you figure out when you're over 40, you figure out that most of the stuff is small stuff. So I think the urgency, I would say, is there, you know. So don't, I would say to my fellow CEOs, don't procrastinate. The best time to plant a tree was 30 years ago. The second best time is today. Let's plant trees and see where they grow. Access global talent. Like you mentioned, there's tons of smart people out there. Find the global talent that works for you. For me, it's in Latin America and in Eastern Europe and Western Asia. I happen to be in Turkey for a lot of my talented data scientists. Identify those sources of talent and use them. And today, I've been evangelizing the world with this message, like the LinkedIn, post a job out there. And put a different global city, put Mexico City or Bogota or Istanbul, put a different city on that job title and translate it into Spanish or Turkish or whatever, and see what comes back. So I do that quite frequently and see what kind of talent is in these. Talking about Bogota with 10 million people, Mexico City, 20 million plus, Istanbul, I don't know what they're at, 13 million. And it's crazy the numbers of people in these cities and in these regions that are just well-educated, super bright, super hardworking. So that's kind of how I look at it. Like, I wouldn't have any fear. I'd be super urgent about experimentation, and the costs are low. I mean, yes, we've seen inflation, but the costs of develop the it's asymmetric. You got an existing business today. Don't cannibalize your existing business, but on the edges, start to experiment because the opportunity for asymmetric returns are so high.
Well, that brings me to another question then. How did you elaborate to find the specific challenges to scale your processes and products? Like, how did you go and do that?
For me, it's talking to customers, right? Like identifying, I don't really, like none of these products are that interesting to me. What's really interesting is that my customer has a problem needs solved. And like one of our modules within our main Viz Banking product focuses on recruiting within the financial services industry. So we kept hearing like, oh, I'm losing my good people and I don't have a good talent slate to know all the people that could fill that job in this area. So it's in some ways, it's like a geographic dislocation. I need some of it's like a lack of knowledge. I need to know the people. I need to know where they are. And I need to know them sometimes in advance for some jobs are more, high demand jobs with limited supply and might take some lead time to fill them, or it might take some lead time to convince the person to come and join my organization. So I did over 100 interviews with my team and myself with an HR person, 15 to 30 minutes. Show me we do like reverse demos. We ask them to show us their process, right? Yeah. And they show us, hey, this is how I'm getting my job done today. And we watch it and we take notes. We ask questions. We don't really comment a whole lot on what their current process is, but we learn as we do that. And then we build into our module. Then we circle back and we sell it to them. And it meets their needs because we listen to what their current process is and their pain points and their challenges and all that stuff. Customers are amazing, right? Whether they're your current customers or your what I call prospects, your future customers.
You know, Brian, I think you've said that very well. I know you've said that very well. You don't have to be the smartest man in the room, the smartest person in the room. You got to bring the right people around you. But most importantly, you got to listen. And listening is something when every CEO comes in is told, you got to come in, you got to do A, B, C, D, hit this hard, you got to do this. So we feel pressures. We put internal pressures on ourselves and push our way through. And we forget the number one thing, listen. You know, this is all the time that we have, and I'd love to speak to you more. And maybe in an upcoming episode, we can have you back again, Brian. I want to thank you so much for your time today and for helping not only myself, but the other CEOs that are out there so they can understand they're not alone. They can understand the challenges and take some of your wisdom and knowledge to help them forward as well. So thank you very much for being a part of Mind Matters, Brian. We really appreciate it.
It's great to be with you.
That's awesome. Thanks, my friend. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. If you found this conversation valuable, please leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. We will see you next time on Mind Matters.